Support for this podcast of The Exchange is brought to you by the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org. That's imagine.dh.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Nationally and here in New Hampshire, many police departments say they're struggling to recruit and retain the best officers. And from big cities to tiny towns, there's a lot of speculation as to why that may be. It could be the pay and benefit packages aren't what they used to be, given limited public dollars and the rising costs of public retirement systems. It may be that the work is seen as more dangerous than in the past, with police confronting the prospect of mass shooters and the crime impacts of an opioid drug crisis. And it could be that policing itself is seen in a harsher light recently, with well-publicized controversies over officer brutality and even the killing of suspects. Today in The Exchange, police recruitment and retention. Where it stands now, how it might change. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. With me in studio is Chief Tony Colarusso. He's chief of the Dover Department. He's also chairman of the Police Standards and Training Council. And Chief Colarusso, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Good morning. Thank you.
Also with us, Chief Bob Cormier. He's chief of the Tilton Police Department and president of the New Hampshire Association of Chiefs of Police. And Chief Cormier, thank you also for being here.
Thank you. Good morning.
We'll also be folding in some other voices throughout the hour. And again, you can join us, 1-800-892-6477. So, gentlemen, here's a quote from a Fox News article that I came across. I'm quoting, "Police departments face a recruiting shortage amid a growing anti-cop mood that some fear has put targets on the backs of men and women in blue." And Chief Colarusso, go to you first. Do you feel this mood?
I would agree to an extent, yes. The issue when you're a young man or a woman thinking, what am I going to do for a career? But every time you turn on the TV, you hear negative information about police, police shootings, police being arrested and charged for making the wrong decision. That has to weigh on people deciding what career they're going to go into.
And how about you, Chief Cormier?
Sure. I don't think it helps. We've always had challenges. And I remember when the economy was really good about 10 or 12 years ago, you know, we were competing against the private sector for pay, for benefits. And I remember that being a challenge back then to try and hire. But certainly if there's an anti-law enforcement climate out there, that doesn't help.
A little bit later, we'll bring in Devin Chafee from the ACLU and talk about that. But since you mentioned the pay and benefits, Chief Cormier, I mean, I don't know, 20, 25 years ago, it seemed like, hey, you could be a police officer. Maybe it's not the highest pay in the world, but it's solid, good retirement, good pay, overtime and so forth. Is that no longer the case?
Well, I think, you know, chiefs and the Chiefs Association and the state, we try to hold on to the best benefits we can because we know that's going to attract better candidates. Police officers will be more invested to stay a whole career and ultimately we'll have better employees. So it's always a challenge for us if we start to see any attempts to deteriorate the retirement system or take away benefits that we have to advocate against that.
What have you heard from departments around the state, Chief Cormier? Again, you're president of New Hampshire Associations of Chiefs of Police. There's a lot of pressure on public retirement systems, public pensions. People are living longer. Healthcare is more expensive. So there's kind of a squeeze there.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, we do appreciate concerns, you know, we realize that, you know, ultimately there's people in charge of budgets, state and local budgets, that have to watch, and be accountable for that. But we also want to make sure that, you know, we're not pushing law enforcement officers to work too long. too many years. You know, it is a high-stress job. So after 25, 30 years in that business, you know, it's been a busy 25 years. So, you know, we try to make sure that the retirement system is fair, it works, and that it attracts new candidates.
What are you guys hearing from people who either are new to your departments or are thinking about joining but are kind of weighing this idea of whether they should join or not? And I'll turn to you first, Chief Colarusso. You know, what are some of the conversations that you have with young men and women in your community about whether or not they should join?
Well, one of the things – the first things they look at if they decide they want to be a police officer, they're looking at the individual departments and what they can offer them in a career, different assignments, promotion opportunities. Then they clearly look at the pay and they clearly look at the benefits, healthcare benefits, because the retirement system in this state is the same for everybody, whether you work in Tilton or Dover or Portsmouth, it's the same.
It's a state-run system, yeah.
They also look at scheduling. So some departments have certain favorable schedules in the recruit's mind or not-so-favorable scheduling. So, for example, do you have a 5-2 schedule? Are you on 5, off 2? Or do you have a 4-3 schedule, 4 10-hour days with 3 days off? And then they'll look at opportunities for overtime. Is there? Can I make additional money? Because, again, the starting pay isn't that great, and expenses are high, vehicles, rent, housing. So they look at the pay. But that's when you really want to be a police officer. If you're deciding and teetering, do I want to be a police officer or not, they might look at that, but they're also looking at a lot of the negatives. The national narrative, shift work is very difficult. And I tell new officers or anybody interested that one of the toughest things you'll deal with is shift work. If you're working midnight shifts, second shift, or rotating shifts, it is tough on the family, on your body, on your sleep pattern. So I try to be realistic when I talk to people and let them know what they're actually getting into. It's nothing like you see on TV. There's there's a lot of you know, mundane things going on, and it's a tiring job and it's a demanding job.
Yeah, I wonder what how often you have to say that to people. It's not like what you see on TV.
Quite often, and some people come in. I tell them to do their research, but some people come in saying, "Yeah, I'd like to be a police officer, but I want to go right into detectives."
Yeah.
Whereas you have to explain to them, well, you start at the entry level. You have to go through the academy, the training, be a patrol officer, learn that, and then compete for assignments such as detective or a canine officer or things like that.
How about you, Chief Cormier? What are some of the expectations of young would-be recruits? Maybe I want to join, maybe I don't. Tell me about it. And you tell them about it and their faces kind of fall and they go, I don't know about that.
You know, I think a lot of times when they graduate college, the only thing they know about law enforcement is what they've seen on TV or heard. And so sometimes, like Chief Colarusso said, they do have misperceptions that it's busy all the time and you know, we solve all crimes in an hour. And
just like, you know, on television.
All those things that you take away from television. But, you know, I really encourage them to come and do ride-alongs, to talk to officers, you know, and have officers that really are dedicated to recruiting so they understand the questions and answers that college students are going to have. And, you know, we've started to work with the universities and talk to the criminal justice chairs or department heads at the CJ programs at the different schools around the state and just start to get a dialogue going with them about coming to, you know, their career days and also get an internship program going with them. It gives students a chance to basically test drive the career and see if they like it.
I have heard in terms of the military, and I want to ask you, gentlemen, if this is the case with your departments, I've heard, Chief Cormier, in terms of the military, people who are looking to join the military, sometimes the military has to say no. You have a small criminal record. You have used drugs, you know, maybe not in a big way, but that's not acceptable. And you're not fit enough. That so you've on one side of the coin, you've got trouble attracting people. On the other side, the people sometimes that do maybe want to come in aren't quite up to what you need. I wonder what you're seeing.
Sure. I mean, what I try to head off those issues, you know, and I think that's part of getting out to them while they're still in college or high school and letting them know what the expectations are physically, and with your lifestyle. And so start to make those changes in your freshman or sophomore year in college, not wait till your senior year and then realize, you know, I made some really bad choices. It's not that they're game enders for you when you apply, but it could delay you getting hired. And I've had kids that went to college in New Hampshire call me and ask for assistance because they're trying to get into the military and they did something stupid in college. And, you know, I'm not opposed to advocating for and helping them because those are the years that you do make some mistakes.
What are you seeing, Chief Colarusso, in terms of the caliber of recruits that you get?
Yeah, it's very tough right now. We just went through two recruiting processes where we didn't select anybody.
Really?
Right. And we interviewed about 40 candidates. We started background investigations on two, and the two that we started background investigations failed the background. So our stance is we're looking for high-quality individuals who meet all the standards and also what Dover is looking for. We have specific things that we feel is important for our community. And if they get into the background phase, that means we really like them. But then if they have issues in the background, character issues, integrity issues, those are the things we look for also, then they don't pass muster. So we'd rather leave a position open than make a mistake in the hiring process.
Well, maybe a little bit later I'll ask specifically what you're looking for in Dover, because different departments do have their own sort of emphasis and things that are going on in their community. But I also want to remind our listeners that you can join us today in the Exchange. We're looking at police recruitment and retention here in the Granite State. From small towns to some of the bigger cities, some departments say they're having trouble attracting and keeping the best officers. We're looking at why, and we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And gentlemen, I want to bring another voice into our conversation for a while. Devin Chafee is with us, Executive Director for the American Civil Liberties Union of New Hampshire. Devin, thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me, Laura.
Well, one of the things that we started out talking about with our two police chiefs who are here in studio is the idea that some people are turned off by all the negative attention that policing has received because of some of the incidents we've seen in cities from Baltimore to Ferguson and so forth. You have focused on how high-profile incidents involving police affect community relations here in New Hampshire. What are you looking at, Devin?
Well, I don't want to say that I would certainly defer to the chiefs as far as really understanding the challenges that they face when it comes to recruitment. But I do think that it's very important to recognize that this issue of public perception of the police in our country is not just a media problem. This is an issue where we have had a number of high-profile incidents, the deaths of Michael Brown, of Eric Garner, Freddie Gray, Tamara Rice. And these aren't just one-off incidences. They're occurring in areas where we're really seeing systematic problems of excessive use of force, in particular against communities of color. And that's not to say that there aren't fine officers serving on the police forces where these incidents are occurring, but this history of excessive use of force has really caused a serious deep rift between the public and the communities and the police departments that serve them. And so what needs to happen going forward within these communities, you know, are real steps and real reforms to demonstrate that there will be accountability, that there will be improved training, and that departments are serious about holding their officers accountable. And we're seeing that nationally with the recent establishment of a new program at the Department of Justice called Policing Practices and Accountability Initiative. The head of that new initiative was just announced yesterday. And this is sort of coming out of the president's task force on 21st century policing. And we're also seeing police departments throughout New Hampshire take certain steps to ensure that they are developing a relationship of trust with the communities that they serve. So we're seeing an increased use of body cameras by police departments throughout the state. And in many instances, it's not just the using the cameras, but these cameras are being accompanied by very clear policies that ensure that the integrity of the footage is protected and that the privacy of individuals in their communities are protected. And when these policies are in place, body cameras can be a real good way to encourage trust with communities. We're seeing really serious community dialogues in areas like Nashua, where you have a very active community activists that are helping the communities engage with the police department, and you have a police department that is very open to that discussion. And what we're also seeing a push for nationally is an increase in collection and public sharing of data on police practices. You know, we don't have, especially in this state, we don't have a lot of information about police activity like stops and frisks and low-level arrests and use of force as it is associated with information like race, gender, age, et cetera. And we could, having more of this type of information is only going to go towards figuring out what reforms need to take place in order to rebuild trust with the police. And
Devin, let me just jump in for a second, because you raise a couple points that I want to raise with our chiefs in studio. And I'm glad you mentioned training, Devin, because Tony Colarusso is not only chief of the Dover Department, he's chairman of the Police Standards and Training Council. And Chief Colarusso, to you, how might better training avoid some of these incidents that, you know, happen in New Hampshire and some of the higher profile incidents that Devin mentioned?
Yeah, I mean, training is critical, and not only how you train, but what you train. So over the past several years, we've really worked more on issues that are emerging, like people working with people who have mental health issues, working with community members, being a guardian versus a warrior. In other words, you're there to serve the public. Sometimes you have to make an arrest and you're going to get into a physical confrontation, but we want you to be more of a server than a guardian of the community. You are serving your community. You become part of your community. So that is a philosophy we've tried to establish and working on quite hard to make sure that is the way we do things in New Hampshire.
That's a tough shift for some folks, isn't it? Again, we were sort of joking earlier, people think policing is what they see on TV. And on TV, you definitely see the warrior. But you're saying that's not the big part of it.
Right. And that comes with the initial hiring. So when departments are hiring, what type of person are you hiring? Are you hiring somebody who their idea of being a police officer is going out and arresting people and chasing people and getting pursuits? That's not the type of person we're looking for. So you have to look for the right person. We're looking for the person who understands that it's really truly service first to the community, and there will be times when you have to be a little tough.
Chief Cormier, this is real interesting, and both of you talked about, you know, sometimes you're recruiting and you get a bunch of people and no one quite stacks up. So that's another factor that you have to think about, even though you don't have that much to choose from. I wonder how you sort of sort through that. I really need two more officers. We're really empty here. But neither of these people, you know, fit that philosophical bill.
Sure. You know, I think Chief Colarusso hits on a good point. We do put an emphasis on trying to get officers that are well-rounded from the start. So they're not just physically fit, mentally prepared for a tough job, but they also have, you know, the personality and the skills to work with the public. On the, you know, community events, to be involved with the public, to have compassion, empathy, to be more involved in the community. So we're part of it, not just a separate entity.
Devin, you also mentioned body cameras, and we're heading into a break, but very quickly, and then we'll pick it up afterwards. What do you think, Devin, overall, are these police body cameras a net benefit to better community policing?
I think that they can be a net benefit if they are accompanied by very clear policies that that ensure that there is public transparency, so the public is getting the footage that they need, and that we're protecting people's privacy, and that the integrity of the footage is collected. Without those policies, they can actually undermine public trust, and that's what we're working on right now over at the State House. There's a bill that will be voted on in January, and my hope is that that bill will create some basic standards for police departments throughout the state of New Hampshire.
Now, those are a lot of ifs, Devin, right? If it's used this way, if it's accessible this way. So lots to sort out there.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it needs to be done right, because if it's not done right, then it's only going to undermine public trust, which may believe that police have the ability to, say, interfere with the integrity of the footage, to turn it on and off whenever they choose, or if the public isn't getting access to the footage that they need, then that's only going to serve to undermine the relationship, not strengthen the relationship with the department.
Okay, and hold on with us, Devin. We'll talk a little bit more about that. And, of course, the flip side is most people have a camera, a video recorder in their pockets because they've got phones. So we'll talk about that and start taking your calls, 1-800-892-6477. I have a bunch of Facebook comments, too, that I want to share with you. So stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, police recruiting in New Hampshire. Departments nationwide and some in the Granite State say they're struggling to attract and retain officers. Several reasons are often cited. The career is seen as less rewarding financially than it once was. And as police themselves come under more scrutiny, some would-be recruits may be hesitant to join the force. We're talking about all this and much more. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. With me in studio, Chief Tony Colarusso. He's chief at the Dover Department and chairman of the Police Standards and Training Council. Also with us, Chief Bob Cormier. He's the chief in Tilton and president of the New Hampshire Association of Chiefs of Police. And joining us for a few more minutes on the phone is Devin Chafee, executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union of New Hampshire. And Chief Colarusso, I'd love your thoughts on what Devin said, that, you know, people think that these body cameras will solve all the problems, but there are a lot of ifs.
Certainly. First of all, I believe what Devin says is accurate. If you're going to do body cams, if you're going to use body cams, you have to do them right. You have to have strict policies. You have to make sure that how you're storing the data and making sure that there's integrity to the system. In Dover, we have not adopted the body cameras yet. We're still looking at it. I don't think I'm opposed to it, but at this point, I'm not for it. I'm still looking at there's financial costs, there's storage of all the data, there's release of the data. We know there's been some issues where right-to-know requests for the data is like on a daily basis, which takes up significant staff
time.
That's
right. Your staff has to work through that.
Right. So we're still looking at that.
So what might tip you over one way or the other? What might be the deciding factor?
Well, one of the things that gives me confidence now is the men and women in my department. We really haven't had any issues. Not to say that mistakes can't be made, but we feel we have a very good relationship with that community. As Devin said, we do a lot of outreach. We have community programs on a consistent basis we've had for several years in place. We're a nationally accredited agency, and we have very sound policies that are viewed as high professional standards. So I just feel comfortable with what's going on. I don't feel there's a need to rush into the body cams at this point.
Is there public pressure around the state, Chief Cormier, for departments to adopt this, or is it basically really each department can choose what it wants to do?
I think it's community by community. Uh-huh. I know some chiefs have been questioned about it and asked to go to them, and some are still holding off because it is an evolving technology. But I think Chief Colarusso and Devin make a lot of great points. But I think if it's done well, it could be a great tool for law enforcement, and it does promote transparency and help build public trust. So,
do you have them in Tilton?
We do.
You
yeah.
do? Okay. Yeah. How long?
We started about 6 months ago.
Wow.
And the officers wanted them. I think the community was accepting of having them. And
the officers wanted them.
Absolutely, sure. Because they work very hard. They're very professional, and they want to know that if someone was to make a false allegation against them, that there'd be some evidence to show that maybe that didn't occur. And so I think I was hearing from a lot of people that it's a good thing. And so for that reason, we decided to try them.
Well, and Devin, on the flip side, we've talking about police body cameras, but everybody also out in the public practically has the ability to film and take pictures on their phones. And some of these incidents nationally that have made bad news for police have come from video that bystanders have taken on their phones. So how does that change the whole sort of narrative about improved community policing, Devin?
Well, I do think, Laura, that it does. I mean, just as body cameras do, when you have things on film, it can be very powerful imagery that reflects a reality of what certain communities are experiencing with their regards to their police. So I do think that the ability of the public to use their own mechanisms to also hold to police the police account accountable is important, and it's been very clearly established that that is a First Amendment right. We have the First Amendment right to videotape the police, and I think that's made clear. There was an issue that had come up here in New Hampshire. It was actually a case in Ware that made its way up to the circuit courts that clearly established that, yes, that right is protected by the Constitution. I also just quickly wanted to talk about this issue of funding of training of police in New Hampshire, because I think we have a real issue in the state in the way that we fund police training, which is so essential and so important. And right now, the way that it's being largely funded is through these penalty assessments that are really dependent on the number of crimes that are being committed, and that really burden those who, in most instances, are the ones who can least afford to pay. What we really need is a clear appropriation that is sufficient for effective and high-quality training of police in this state. And I really think we need to reexamine the way that New Hampshire is funding police training, because it is so important and so essential.
Well, Devin, good to talk to you. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Laura.
That's Devin Chafee, Executive Director for the American Civil Liberties Union of New Hampshire. Before we go to our listeners, Chief Colarusso, I did want to let you jump in on that as well. I know that's a sore subject for you, the funding of police training and how that's going down.
Yes, and currently we're funded through a penalty assessment. So a simple example would be if you get a speeding ticket and you pay a $100 fine, you're also going to pay a $24 penalty assessment. And 16 of those dollars will go to the police standards and training. For training, $4 will go to the court system, and $4 go to a victim fund. And so I don't think a lot of people realize that, but I do see the conflict in that some people would believe, well, the officers are out there writing tickets and arresting people so they can fund their own training. That hasn't been my experience. I remember when I was a young officer, I had no idea where that money went, and I didn't really care. I was too busy trying to do the job. And I think that's true of most officers. But what has happened is that this started in 1972, I believe, because we didn't have a police academy. We didn't have training. So,
is that unusual? Do most states have a police training academy?
Oh, yes. Currently now, of course. But back in the 60s and 70s, there was a huge lack of training for law enforcement.
Sort of department by department and whatever you
Correct.
Could squeeze in.
Correct.
Yeah.
And so we needed a funding source. So they came up with this idea. It seemed to make sense that, you know, well, let's let the people who commit violations pay for training, and when they're found guilty by a court of law, they'll pay a penalty assessment. But that revenue that's been coming in over the years has started to decrease. And for whatever reason that is, and we all have our theories, and some are accurate and some may not be, the revenue is falling. And the way police and training is council is funded is we get a budget through the governor's office and then, you know, affirmed through the Senate and the House. For example, and I'm using round numbers here, of $3.2 million. And that would be enough to fund the training and keep our training specialists and at appropriate levels. But if the revenue is below that, if the penalty assessment funds come in at $2.6 million, we can only spend up to that $2.6 million. So we're currently at a crisis level where the revenue has been falling for the past several years, and now it's reached a point of crisis.
And as I understand, you're cutting back some video conferencing and not bringing or telling people from faraway departments that they have to drive to Concord for the training and so forth. So it's kind of a burden on some of these smaller departments in far-flung areas.
Yeah, we've had to. We've been forced. The council has been forced to have the director reduce staff. We eliminated police training grants. We've eliminated some training that the council would pay for officers to come in. And we've also closed our remote sites. Like you said, the North Country had a remote training site, which we've had to eliminate the contract for that.
What does that mean for departments, especially ones that aren't as close to Concord as yours, Chief Cormier? You're in Tilton. What does that mean that those officers won't get that they might have gotten in an earlier, more flush era at the training academy? What sorts of, you know, training won't they get now?
Well, there's a lot of career development training that we hosted there, and if that isn't available, that's the type of training that it all circles around to some of the things we were talking about earlier, you know, as far as community policing, community involvement, and how to get police departments and their officers more engaged in the community. and, you know, address some of the things that Chief Colarusso and Devin were talking about earlier. That's that enhanced training that we try to get into officers each year. And also to, you know, recap and kind of look in the mirror at law enforcement each year and say, you know, where do we need to change policy, practices? And that's all that training that wouldn't be available any longer. So, you know, with a lack of that training, we're only going to see more issues, not less.
Let's go to our listeners, and then I have a lot more questions for both of you. Again, the number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Join us as we look at this issue of police retaining and recruitment and some of the struggles that some departments are having, especially smaller departments here in New Hampshire. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And gentlemen, let's go to the phones. And Sheila joins us from Putney, Vermont. Hi, Sheila. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Sure can. Go ahead, Sheila.
Great. I'm just really thrilled to hear the discussion about the whole training issue, because it seems to me that that's really the key and the connection between that and community policing and community training. It's almost like we've got to train the community as well as the police department. And I just wanted to mention one thing, specific thing, which is that I have a friend who's working in Atlanta, and she is a former teacher at a police academy, and she is developing a program to teach police about the whole concept of racial profiling. She feels like, and that may not seem like a huge issue in New England, where the racial differences are not so obvious, but I mean, maybe they're more obvious. But she thinks that that's a really key place where we have to begin to do, you know, some real discernment, particularly in connection with the community.
Well, I'm glad you called, Sheila, because in a few minutes we are going to talk to somebody who's specifically involved in that issue. But do you want to jump in on that, Chief Colarusso, this idea of, you know, working with communities of color and how that's involved in the training? And then this has been, I mean, top of the news a lot of the time when there's a white officer and an African-American suspect.
Yeah, and it really boils down to, again, hiring the right people who can deal with other humans at the highest level of integrity. And we try to make sure we screen that out in the hiring process, and then also the training involved about what's acceptable, what's not acceptable. And then the supervision, layers of supervision is very important, and then tracking. We do bias-based policing statistics in our department. It's part of our accreditation process where we have to track who's being stopped, what time, even demographics to an extent, and, you know, the race of the person, age. And we have to look at our community demographics. If we have 90% Caucasian and 10% minority, but we're stopping 50% of the minority, that's a problem. You know, and we have to track that.
That's bias-based tracking. That's what that's called. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, there's bias-based policing. But we also have to look at tracking those statistics. And every department should be doing it, whether you're accredited or not. That's what supervisors in the administration do, oversight of what the officers on the street are doing on a day-to-day basis. You have to keep track of that.
Sheila, thank you so much for the call. Did you want to jump in, Chief Cormier, on that?
Sure. I just think she makes a really good point, you know, and I think it does circle around to not only training the officers, but, and you know, I'll rephrase, she said train the community, because really each has a, you know, a perception of each other. So, you know, in a racially diverse community, you know, one segment of that community may be a particular race. They may have a perception, a negative perception of the police department that they don't care about that part of the city, or they don't care about the folks that live there. And that's an image, you know, for the law enforcement agency that has to change. And then also, you know, you don't want the officers to develop some sort of opinion that part of the city doesn't care about them either, so they become cynical. And so the only way to attack those issues is training and community meetings and kind of break it down for both sides. So she made a really good point.
All right. Sheila, thank you so much for the call. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And another call, gentlemen. This is Alex in Rochester. Hi, Alex. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I used to live in Dover a number of years ago. I myself am a person who has a history and a diagnosis of a mental illness from which I am recovering with professional help. But at the time, back in 1999 and 2000, I lived in a rooming house in Dover where I was renting a room on the top floor where everybody else was renting a room as well in different rooms in the building. And there was an incident there involving the Dover police. And I say this not to, you know, cast a negative light on the entire police department, but I just have questions about this particular incident where there was a man who lived, he rented a room across the hall from me. He himself also had a mental illness, apparently. And the police, for some reason, I don't remember why, but for some reason he refused to leave his room. And as I recall, if I recall correctly, the landlord of the building called the police. The police then came in and knocked on his door repeatedly, requested him to leave. And not within 10 minutes, they used a tear gas to get him out. And I was living across the hall, so I had to leave the building too, even though I had done nothing wrong. I just couldn't breathe in there.
Wow.
And so I was wondering, you know, this may have been just, you know, I don't know, like an exception to the rule. I don't know, maybe, and I don't know this particular individual's history who used tear gas, I guess.
Well, and Alex, we won't go into the details of what happened, although I'm glad you called and told us your story. Chief Colarusso, you know, you probably weren't there at the time. I'm not sure. And I don't want to ask you to address something that happened a while back. But the broader issue Alex raises is important. And both of you have addressed it already. The idea that, you know, police in New Hampshire have had to deal with people who are sometimes in the throes of a mental health crisis. And it's really hard. And I have heard police complain that, you know, hey, let's strengthen the mental health system so that we're not on the front lines. We're police officers. We're not mental health professionals. So, Alex, I'm really glad you called. What are your thoughts there, Chief Colarusso?
Well, I would have to know the specific details. And again, I know we're talking in general, but every use of force incident is reviewed. Officers have to justify everything they do and why they do it. And, of course, the perception from the outside could be excessive force. So why do they have to do that? Or why did they have to do that, take that type of action? But our policies and training dictate what the officers can and can't do. And if officers make mistakes, and they do, they're held accountable.
How is the thinking around people in the midst of a mental health crisis, Chief Cormier? How has that changed? How has the training changed? Again, I hear police say, look, the mental health system has been breaking down, has been fraying for the last 20 years, and we're bearing the brunt of it.
Sure. You know, I've heard that. I've heard there's less resources available for folks with mental illness and less places for them to stay and homeless. And so law enforcement, to be, I think, the best we can be, we have to train with it and talk to the professionals, make sure our officers understand mental illness and how to deal with it, because throughout the course of their day and their shift, inevitably they're going to have to. And so that all boils back to why we're trying to add more training at the academy to make sure officers get this, because it's not just new officers, but it's officers that have been on the job 10 and 20 years that maybe didn't get that training back in the 70s or 80s. That now need it because, you know, society is always changing and evolving with new challenges. And so for law enforcement, the things we learned 10 or 15 years ago have changed as well. And so we have to keep that ongoing training, and mental illness is one of those areas.
We did a whole program on that. I remember a couple years ago, Chief Colarusso, about the training around mental illness. Does that still go on at the training academy?
Yes, and we've increased it over the last couple of years, trying to – there's so many – topics. So we spend as much time as we can each topic. We realize the mental illness topic is very important, and the officers need to know how to recognize it, how to diffuse situations, and what to do in each case.
Alex, thank you so much for calling. We'll take more of your calls after a short break. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, police recruitment and retention in New Hampshire. We're talking about some of the struggles that some local departments have had attracting and keeping the best officers. We've also talked a lot about training and what that involves, some of the cutbacks that have happened there. You can join us with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Chief Colarusso, Chief Cormier, let's go right back to our listeners. And Jim is calling from Hooksett. Hi, Jim. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi. How you doing?
Fine. Go ahead.
I'm really upset with these with the problems that the police are having. I've over the years, from the 60s up to the 90s, I was involved in my share of petty crimes in Manchester, and we had a higher amount of respect for the police. And nowadays, I find that every time there's a high-profile incident, the media jumps in and blames the police. When you actually look at the situation, you look at somebody like that kid in Ferguson. If he complies with the police officer, he's not dead. The guy that got the chokehold in New York, if he complies with the police officer, he's not dead. Every time one of these incidents happen, they jump. Nobody ever comes out and says, you know, it's the fault of that guy there, not the police. They had no choice but to use force of one form or another.
What
and I think somebody has to get to a point where you find out where this lack of respect came from that seems to be pervasive in the criminal community. Where are all these kids getting this attitude that the police are nobody?
Jim, thank you so much for calling in. And this is very tricky, and I really appreciate the call. It's hard to know what happens in these situations. I think, Chief Colarusso, in situations where the suspect ends up dead and then it turns out he or she was unarmed, people get really upset. So I just love your broad thoughts on Jim's comment.
Well, and they should become upset. But there needs to be, instead of an instant reaction, we can't really do that. We have to do a thorough investigation through our processes to understand exactly what happened before a determination is made. And in New Hampshire, we're fortunate that we have an attorney general, an attorney general's office, who will come in and conduct these investigations and ensure the integrity of the facts. And I know some people are skeptical even of that. But
yeah, feel like the AG is always on your side.
Sure. But from my experience, it's a tough process. And we've been involved in incidents in shooting investigations where the attorney general has come in. And they've done a very thorough job, and it's all about integrity again. So each case is different. We know there's now the famous cases, the Ferguson in New York and in Baltimore.
Which was just in the news today. Yeah.
Sure. But, you know, I really feel, again, it comes back to hiring, supervision, policies, and especially training. And that's why, especially in light of what's going on with the national narrative, that we not only have to maintain our training levels, but we have to increase our training levels.
Well, and it's interesting what our caller says. And thank you again for calling in, Jim. Chief Cormier, he says, hey, I was involved in petty crime in Manchester in my youth, he said. But he said he felt like when he was young, there was more respect for police. I wonder what you think.
Sure. You know, I think the majority of the people in any community, whether it's here or California, they want to have a safe community. They want to like their police department, trust them, and respect them. And I think the majority do. One thing I've seen, Laura, recently, probably within the last year, is a phenomenon of total strangers coming up to me and shaking my hand and saying, I appreciate what you do, and just know that we support you. And I've really never seen it to this degree as I have this year. So I think it just kind of circles back to what Jim said. There are a lot of people out there that do care and support us. I don't know that all the officers know that, but I try to relay that message to them. And the only thing I would ask, you know, with some of the high-profile incidents is you know, caution people not to draw an early conclusion because, like Chief Colarusso said, trying to make a decision off maybe 25 or 30 seconds of a piece of video really doesn't tell the whole story. You know, what did the officers know at the time? What did the radio traffic say? You know, where were the people in danger in the area? That sort of thing. So there's so many pieces to that investigation, more than just a video. And so, but there again, we have to make sure that we communicate as much as we can about it as it's going on. And I think that helps people.
You know, I've got a tough question for you guys. And with all these incidents that you know, make big headlines and so forth. Front page of the Concord Monitor, union leader. My two kids see some of these headlines and they say, "Mom, the guy was unarmed. Why couldn't he have just tased the guy?" You know, because they play video games and they watch, you know, shows and so forth. So what are your thoughts on that, Chief Colarusso? In some of these incidents where suspects are unarmed, they're fleeing, what would you say to my kids who say, "Mom, why couldn't he just tase the guy?"
Well, if I felt the officer made a mistake, I would say that that officer made a mistake in that situation. The person was running away from them. They didn't appear to be armed. And maybe just the officer made a mistake. But I can tell you, your child, that we have thousands and thousands and thousands of incidents with people, and very, very, very few end up in any type of shooting at all. In fact, as we know, most police officers go through their entire career without ever shooting their firearm. And that goes for small towns and big cities.
I didn't know that, really.
Sure.
Again, that's not the impression you get from the news and from television.
It's I think it's over 97% of officers will never fire their weapons in a career.
Well, gentlemen, I want to bring another voice into our conversation and then go back to our listeners. And I want to thank everybody who's called. We've got a lot of emails and Facebook comments, too. But joining us now is Eddie Edwards. He's a former police chief in Southampton, current chair of the State Advisory Group on Juvenile Justice and co-chair of its Disproportionate Minority Contact Committee. And Eddie Edwards, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Good morning, gentlemen.
I wanted to ask you about that Disproportionate Minority Contact Committee, and I think Chief Colarusso touched on it earlier when he talked about bias-based tracking, but what does that mean exactly, Eddie Edwards, Disproportionate Minority Contact Committee?
Well, that looks at the overrepresentation of minority juveniles in the juvenile justice system as they have contact throughout the juvenile justice system, and based upon their population rate. So we look at their contact with the juvenile justice system based off their population rate within the state.
So in other words, as Chief Colarusso said, if a community is 90% white, 10% minority, but 40% of your arrests are minority, then you need to look at that.
Correct.
Would you say New Hampshire has a problem with this, or do we do a pretty good job in terms of not having disproportionate contact, if I could use that word?
Well, I think the good news here is that New Hampshire, believe it or not, has been the only state in the country that has shown a consistent reduction in DMC for the last 2 years. The only state in the country. The county is, our state was Hillsborough that showed that reduction. And, of course, those are our two largest cities, Manchester and Nashua. And when you look, respectively, Nashua has roughly about a 20% minority-based population. Manchester has close to 16% minority-based population. So there, we're doing a great job there. Is there improvement? Absolutely. And every day that we're working on these issues, and it goes back to leadership. We've been very successful as a state because of the leadership in our state.
Is this relatively new, Eddie, this effort?
No. Well, our efforts in New Hampshire, the issue has... It's not new, particularly.
I mean the effort in New Hampshire, sure.
Right. The effort in New Hampshire, yes. This happened, our efforts changed, I'm going to say, about 5 or 6 years ago when we started to bring on different people, different voices. We have a gentleman, Andrew Smith, who is our state coordinator, Pam Sullivan. These two individuals work on this issue daily, and they're doing a fantastic job. And then, you know, we've had some police leadership around the state to work on these issues. You know, Don Vittem, at the director of the Training Academy, has been very gracious and helpful in getting these programs taught to police officers all over the state. And then you have chiefs like Dave Mara, the current chief of Manchester, Nick Willard, the chiefs in Nashua, former chief, current chiefs in Rochester. So there's been a lot of work going on to drive this issue and change the dynamics in our state.
What was it that sparked this interest in getting this going 5 or 6 years ago?
Well, I think when I was appointed to the State Advisory Group on Juvenile Justice at the time by Governor Lynch, we began to take a look at this issue. And like all things, if you want to make changes, you can't just sit around and talk about it. You actually have to put things in motion. So we set out by first trying to take a temperature of what was going on in New Hampshire with the minority community, particularly young people, and look at the training levels. And So over that time, we developed a couple of training programs that have become national models that actually the federal government under the Office of Juvenile Delinquency and Prevention is looking at. One of our programs is engagement, law enforcement engagement training programs, and that started off actually in Connecticut. That now in New Hampshire, we put our own spin on it, and now it's one that people look to us to provide that leadership and guidance on.
Well, that's really interesting. So a national model for training police with how to engage with minority youth. Can you give us an example? Again, you know, most people listening aren't directly engaged in these issues, Eddie. Can you just give us an example of how police 15 years ago might have approached those situations and how they do now, given the attention that you and others have been paying to it?
Well, first, I think it can't be about political correctness. I think early on, our training models, when we talked about diversity, we just talked about comfort levels, trying to ease people's comfort. And it's not the training programs are not focused on that. They're focused on an actual appreciation and respect for people who are different and understanding their cultures and their dislikes and likes. And this is just not focused on blacks and Latinos. I mean, there's a whole gamut of folks who fall on that category of minority community, and also poor white individuals as well, who may find themselves being disrespected at some level or feeling disrespected at some level. And so years ago, the police training focused on diversity in a different way, but now these programs now bring actual police officers into the classroom, into the discussion, and have that actual engagement with young people so that young people feel very comfortable in reaching out and touching the police officers in their communities and abroad. Because what we're trying to do is show that that uniform is not your enemy. The man and the woman in that uniform, they live in your community, they love their community like you do, they're your friends, they're your neighbors.
How robust an effort do you see, Eddie, in terms of recruiting police from minority communities or women, for example? So there's one end, better engagement with minority communities, especially youth that you've been working on. What are your thoughts on the other end of recruiting folks from, you know, backgrounds that aren't always represented on police forces?
Well, I think that's improving. That's improving. As you can see, there's been a slight shift in our demographics amongst minority law enforcement officers. But it's very difficult to recruit women and minorities into this profession. Now, that's not to say the efforts aren't going on. I think individual police departments do a great job of trying to do that. We developed a program a couple of years ago where we actually partnered with the New Hampshire Southern University, University of New Hampshire, to drive a recruitment program there. And unfortunately, I think we had one or two female students who showed up, but the majority of the students in the audience were white men. And we gave the program to them as well because that's important. And I think that's what's going to drive recruitment better, is that when minorities and women feel welcome into the profession. And we know they are. Those of us who have been in the profession for a long time, we understand they are. But perception is reality. So if people don't feel welcome, if they feel like this is a profession that doesn't belong to them, they won't come. So I think we've done a pretty good job in New Hampshire trying to do that. Just more work to be done.
Well, lots more to talk about, Eddie Edwards, but I will let you go. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, not a problem. Thank you for having me.
That's Eddie Edwards, former police chief in Southampton, and as we heard, co-chair of the State Advisory Group on Juvenile Justice and the Disproportionate Minority Contact Committee. And boy, gentlemen, lots more questions and comments from our listeners. Eddie Edwards mentioned trouble recruiting women and minorities to police departments. I have a Facebook comment, and Justin, I'm sorry I don't have time to read the whole thing, but he also feels, Chief Colarusso, that there's some sexism in police culture and that that's turning women off from joining the force. And again, you know, Eddie Edwards said he's trying, but perception is reality.
Yeah, I mean, it is a male-dominated profession, but my daughter's a nurse. And she's in a female-dominated profession, and she talks about how men don't want to become nurses, and they're in the minority, if you will. But we do try to recruit minorities and women. We only have 5 women at Dover PD, but 2 of them are sergeants, and one of our ladies is on the mounted patrol. We have a horse patrol. She's on the mounted patrol.
You have a horse patrol in Dover?
Yeah. Yeah, we have two horses full-time, and they patrol the downtown. And again, that's part of our community outreach effort because they're so approachable People come up and talk to them when they're on the horses. They love the horses. So that comes into that whole community reach out. And what Eddie talked about juveniles, that's critical. And I think the school resource officers are important there, that those officers assigned to schools. We have a middle school officer and a high school officer who focus on positive relations with the students, all of the students. We run a teen center out of the police department. For at-risk youth who from sixth grade and above come and receive homework help from UNH interns, University of New Hampshire interns, and they receive different programming. So you have to do a lot to reach out, and some of that has bubbled up into recruitment. We've had people volunteer at the teen center, and then one of them became a police officer in Dover.
Here's an email from someone who didn't want a name used. So this person says, I was concerned to see an ad in our local newspaper looking for new policemen. The applicants only needed a high school education. For such a sensitive, important job, I would think a college education would be needed. 75% to 80% of our local high school students go to college. It concerns me that our policemen and women come from the other 20%. Who are not motivated or qualified to go to college. This lack of education, in my opinion, this person says, contributes to the problem we have with police today nationwide. I guess I would add some people might want to go to college, but they can't afford it because it's so expensive. But what do you think about this, Chief Cormier, concern from this person that only a high school education is needed?
Sure. You know, I tell, young teens and young adults that are thinking about a career in law enforcement that college is so important. And obviously that window of opportunity when you graduate high school is the perfect opportunity to get it done. And it does give them an edge in the hiring process. You know, we look for college graduated, whether it be an associate or a bachelor's degree. But we also look about, the individual's personality. Are they a right fit for this job? It gets back to people that care, officers that are going to care about people at the end of the day. And so, but certainly it is a requirement in some agencies, but not all. But it's definitely a goal of ours, because education and training really is the key.
That's what we keep getting back to. All right. Well, we'll have to have you gentlemen back to talk about this whole body camera and smartphone camera, because I think that's a whole another issue we could explore. I want to thank everybody also who commented on Facebook. And the conversation continues on Facebook after the program. So go ahead and check it out. And Chief Tony Colarusso, Chief Bob Cormier, thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.